Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Welcome to this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Julian Chang, and I'll be your moderator tonight. It is my pleasure and honor to welcome to the Commonwealth Club Kate Kendall. Leonardo da Vinci said that people of accomplishment rarely sit back and let things happen to them. Instead, they go out and happen to things. I can't think of another person who has not let things happen to her, nor has she let events just pass her by. Kate Kendall has led the National Center for Lesbian Rights with distinction, honor, and integrity. The motto of NCLR is the audacity to fight for justice, the perseverance to win. It indicates a fighting spirit and a distinctive voice. In fact, this month we are celebrating at the Commonwealth Club Women of Distinction through our series called The Ascent of Woman. And Kate joins such notables as First Lady Rosalynn Carter and the talented violinist Midori and many, many other women who have shared their life stories, their journeys, and most importantly, their visions, each of them with a distinctive voice. For after all, Billie Holiday said, "If I'm going to sing like someone else, I don't need to sing at all." And yet, with a clarion voice, Kate has, over these years, led us to a better place. We all come from different ships, but we're all in the same boat now. And I can't think of a better person at the helm of our thought leadership than Kate Kendall. Please join me in welcoming our distinguished guest tonight, Kate Kendall.
Well, thank you so much, Julian, for that very generous introduction. That's the sort of introduction that my mother would say. You should just get off the stage and say thank you at that point. I really do appreciate all those kind remarks and, you know, hope to live up to them to some degree. I do feel like it is a privilege and an honor to be able to do the work that I do and to be invited by the Commonwealth Club and Julian to speak tonight really underscores that privilege. And to be able to talk about LGBT issues, women's issues, and a little bit about my journey to this work has provided a great opportunity for reflection at a level of 30,000 feet, something I don't often get to do. And today seems like a particularly auspicious day to talk about these issues, given that it is the 90th anniversary of the ratification of the 19th Amendment, of course, giving women the right to vote. Now, we look back and we think about this milestone anniversary and we think, well, how quaint that is that we're celebrating the right of women to vote. Not really recognizing, I think, for many, especially for many who do not know much about the history of that struggle, that it was the culmination of a 70-year-long effort fraught with much disagreement, very hostile feelings on many sides, even early suffragists tainting some of their views in favor of the women's right to vote with racist language, a view not embraced in terms of having women having the right to vote by many states in the South. Most of the South held out in ratifying the 19th Amendment, and even after it was ratified because they hit the magic number that they needed, it wasn't until 1985 that Mississippi finally ratified the 19th Amendment. So you look at that struggle, and you have to think, when you think about LGBT issues, it's nice to have some context and to understand that even though our fight for LGBT equality and dignity and fairness can seem painful, difficult, sometimes as if we're taking more steps back than we are step forward, we're not alone. And every other struggle for social justice, for civil rights, has had a very similar and, in many cases, much more difficult trajectory. There was a New York Times story this last Sunday that talked about how the issue of same-sex marriage, for example, an issue that is above the fold almost daily when it comes to discussions of LGBT equality, talking about how attitudes have changed on the issue of the right of same-sex couples to have the right to marry. And the New York Times story reported on a CNN poll that reports for the first time above 50% support for the right of same-sex couples to marry in this country. And more important, the story reports that for those folks under 30, there is majority support in every single state for the right of same-sex couples to marry. Not very long ago, in fact, in the 10 years since I've been executive director at NCLR, which is 14 years, we've seen a total turnaround just on that issue. So there's lots of reason for optimism. But, you know, I don't need the New York Times to tell me that. I get to see that every day in the work that I do. And I also get to see it when I look back at my own life and my coming out, my coming to do this work. Many of you know that I grew up Mormon in Utah. As I like to say, the quintessential good girl gone bad. And I was in a family where no generation before me had had anyone who had gone to college. My family was very working class in terms of its background, striving middle class, and my father would hasten to add, in terms of where he wanted the family to be economically. But I was in a very homogeneous state and felt really the press of what was required in order to fit in. And I chafed against that, but not to very good result, I will say, in my early teen years, until I got into middle school and had, as many of us did, that transformational moment when we had a teacher. And in my case, my teacher in eighth grade was Mrs. Miller. And Mrs. Miller taught social studies and current events. And she taught us not just about, you know, Martin Luther King and John F. Kennedy. She taught us about Nat Turner, Malcolm X, Chief Joseph, Sojourner Truth, Abigail Adams, and many other women cast in that mold of rebellious person. And I learned so much in terms of my worldview. And she seemed, I don't know why she singled me out for this particular attention, but she seemed to think that in me was someone who these kinds of lessons and this kind of learning would resonate with. So she really focused on understanding the connections of past civil rights struggles and all of the figures, not just the ones that even white people in Utah were comfortable hearing about, but others as well. And I learned two things from her. One, being rebellious, being radical, is a good thing, and that no movement succeeds by itself. And both lessons have had an enormous impact on me. At that time, I was struggling with my sexual orientation, but did not know it. I don't know if it's true for most young girls who then come out later as lesbians, but I do think there's a different experience for women than for men. And we were talking just before the program, and this sort of seemed true. Men seem to know earlier and can identify it, what it is, that they have an attraction to other men. With girls, we just think we have really close girlfriends. And we don't have a sexual language or a sexual frame for that. Nevertheless, that coupled with Mrs. Miller, coupled with sort of my natural outlook, you know, there was no doubt that I was the rebellious kid in our family. I was the oldest of three, and I was clearly the one that I think my mother was most worried about, for very good reason. And when I finally did come out in a more public way, not just to myself and the woman I was involved with, but to the broader world, and when I left the church, the Mormon Church. It had actually less to do, my leaving the church, with being a lesbian, and a lot more to do with being a feminist. And I remember having specific conversations with one particular history teacher in college who was a mentor of mine, who was a very devout Mormon, but a very liberal guy and called himself a feminist and spoke in very feminist kind of language. And I remember saying to him, I can no longer be involved in the church and be a feminist. Those two identities just don't hold true for me. Now, of course, what I wasn't telling him is, oh, and by the way, I sleep with women. Is that going to be a problem? There was a way in which I was thinking, I couldn't be involved in the church intellectually, and it made my break, actually, with my faith, the church of my childhood, much easier because it was an intellectual attraction to the church. The church fed an intellectual need, a need to be part of a community. It never really spoke to my heart. What spoke to my heart was being the rebellious one, being the radical, being the feminist. But I understood also the importance of community, having grown up in a community like Utah, where you do see neighbors helping neighbors and families helping families and a sort of shared sense of worldview and ideas and a sense of caring for each other. So that was a very important part of my thinking of how I wanted to be in community with other people once I finally found the people who were my people and who thought the way I did and had the worldview that I did. Now, another thing that shaped my sense of who I am and my sense of what's possible in the world was my mom. I came out to my mother when I was 19. We were driving to Oregon to see my grandparents. Portland, Oregon is where I was born and where my mother's parents still lived. I don't know why I chose to tell her this when we were in a moving vehicle, but it seemed like a good idea at the time. And I was really concerned about how she would respond because even though my father wasn't active in the Mormon church, my mother was the devout one. My mother was a true believer. We went to church every Sunday. We had family home evening every Monday led by her. When my father wasn't around, we prayed before every meal. And my mother talked about her testimony and her love of the Savior and her love of her religion. So I was nervous about telling her that I was a lesbian. And I told her, sitting in the car as we were driving, I said, Mom, I have something to tell you, but I'm scared. And she said, well, honey, there's nothing you could tell me that should make you scared. Just tell me. And I said, okay, well, I'm gay. And she paused for a second, and she started to get a little bit emotional, and she said, honey, that's okay. The most important thing to me is that you're happy. And my mother never changed from that perspective. That was her feeling then. She never wavered from it. She never soft-pedaled it. She never had a but or a however or a oh, but I wish. It was unbridled, unconditional love and support. And I just wish every kid could have that kind of love and support. There would be an end to so much of the other pain and the sense of rejection that so many in our tribe feel when their families react the way they do around sexual orientation. And then just as a quick aside, you know, I always questioned a little bit that my mother's reaction. I wondered if maybe privately, you know, she was putting on a brave face because she felt like this was the right thing to do. There's a journal after my mother's death that we found. I didn't realize my mother had kept journals, but she had a whole stack of these journals. And I ended up reading one of them from back, probably during the, well, it had to be during this time when I was 19 in the early 80s. This would be 1979, 1980. I was reading this journal, and I happened on her telling of the story of me coming out to her. And I kind of steeled myself a little bit. I thought, okay, this is it. This is when I get how she really felt in that moment. And there was this sentence where she wrote, I'm just so heartbroken. And I thought, oh, man, this is how she really felt. I'm just so heartbroken that Kathy, my mother, what my family called me, that Kathy went through so much pain and didn't feel like she could tell me this earlier. So, knowing who my mother was and how she was with me, is a key part of not just who I am and how I live, but why I always feel this sense of tremendous optimism and hope, even when we do have the moments of two steps back. Because my mother instilled in me a belief that anything is possible. Even what you don't believe can happen or don't truly feel is within your grasp, it is possible. So I've been at NCLR for 16 years now. I started as legal director and then became executive director in 1994. And in 1994, you look at this New York Times article from Sunday, 25% of the population in the United States supported the right of same-sex couples to marry. In 16 years, we've moved 25% more of the population. Now, that has leapfrogged over generations of what usual struggles have to go through in order to meet a certain level of popular support for who they are and their lives. But it's important to also note that even when we win marriage, or even when we have marriage victories, that's not enough. And there's a disconnect, I think, sometimes in our community between winning formal legal equality, which people see as the end-all and be-all of equality and dignity in this country, and really true cultural change. And you can see this in the midst of any other civil rights movement. You can win formal legal equality. Women won suffrage. We won the right to vote 90 years ago. And we still make 77 cents to every dollar a man makes. We still have sexism still runs rampant. Try buying clothes for your 8-year-old daughter that seem age appropriate. You know, it's in every little part of this culture we still see seeds of sexism and misogyny. The 14th Amendment. The 14th Amendment made everybody equal in terms of race, right? Hey, and we have an African-American president. We're done, right? Well, we all know that racism, white supremacy, marginalization based on race is still rampant in this country. And if anything, having President Obama as the leader of the United States has only made those conversations even more raw and more surfaced than they ever were before. And with LGBT people and doing work on behalf of LGBT people, you see the intersection of all of this. Because in every other community, well, not every other community, but in many other communities, there's one key identity that unites those folks, whether it's based on gender or based on race or based on religion or alienage. When it comes to the lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender community, we cross every one of those identities. We are every religion, we are every class, we are every race, we are every socioeconomic status. We live in small towns, we live in big cities, we're conservative, we're progressive. We cross multiple identities. So in the work that we do at NCLR, one of the biggest challenges is approaching our community in a way that lets our clients, our donors, the people we interact with, bring their full selves to the work that we do. So for us, yes, we are at the forefront of winning the right to marry for same-sex couples in this country. But we know that that's not going to be the brass ring, no pun intended. We know that that's not going to be what will win full equality for LGBT people. Because we also, in addition to working on marriage, we work on issues facing LGBT youth, particularly in foster care and juvenile justice. Those systems are broken systems in this country for actually every kid, but particularly for LGBT kids. Winning marriage is not going to solve that issue. We work on immigration and asylum on behalf of individuals who faced certain death based on torture, harassment, violence in their home countries, who make it to the United States seeking asylum based on their gender expression or their sexual orientation. Winning marriage will not make their home country a safe place for them. So when we do this work, we understand, and I think as a community we need to understand, that we all in this tribe live at some intersection. An immigrant lives at the intersection of xenophobia, sometimes racism, socioeconomic hardship, and sexual orientation or gender identity. And if we don't see how toxic that intersection is, if we only take care of one avenue into that intersection, we are only doing part of the work to achieving real social justice. Mandy Carter said in a speech once, who's an African-American activist, lives in North Carolina, that when we think about justice, it has to be more than just us. You know, it's sort of a simple little phrase and a little turn of phrase, but it really, I think, illustrates what is an important challenge and also a really important value that our movement, particularly given how unique we are and given the multiple intersections in our community, could emulate and could lead other movements and could help to be a greater unifying force. Now, obviously, even though marriage is not going to be the holy grail of winning full equality, justice, dignity, and the right to live authentic lives for LGBT people, clearly it is a fight that we are in. And in that fight has been the sort of conversation and the sort of dialogue that has opened up a number of different possibilities for moving a whole range of our issues forward and changing hearts and minds. And particularly the Prop 8 fight is, I think, a perfect example of what we've seen. So we all know what's been happening with Prop 8. Anybody here not know what's been happening with Prop 8? Okay, good. So Prop 8 is now up on appeal after this amazing decision from Judge Von Walker here in San Francisco, an incredible opinion that everyone should read. I don't care if you're a lawyer or not. If you want to have your life as a human being affirmed, you should read Judge Von Walker's opinion, whether you're gay or not or a lawyer or not. It really is about such a sense of common humanity and how we should really think about the value of people under the law and under a constitutional system and a democracy. And of course, the trial in that case was a masterwork, led not by a gay organization, but by two very unlikely partners, David Boies and Ted Olson. David Boies, who was just here a couple of weeks ago speaking to the Commonwealth Club on the day of Von Walker's ruling, and getting emotional. Here is this very high-powered, highly paid D.C. attorney on the side of the right, I mean, on the side of Gore in the Bush v. Gore fight, and Ted Olson, his nemesis in every other way, except both of them united in believing that when the Constitution says everyone has the right to equal protection under the law, it means everyone, including LGBT people, our relationships, and our families. And these two men, given their stature, given who they are, given who they know, given their connections, would never be involved in this kind of a fight if our movement were not at a tipping point. And every civil rights movement, whether it's the suffragists, whether it's African-American civil rights, whether it's religious fights, always has a tipping point when all of a sudden unlikely allies are on your side and standing with you. And unlikely allies, not just who we've always had allies. We've had parents who've been on our side. We've had coworkers. We've had family members. But of a stature where they can influence others just by their being involved. And regardless of what might happen as the Prop 8 case moves forward, and, you know, I have no better guess on that than anyone here about what might happen with that, having Ted Olson and David Boies involved is a game-changing moment. And it is a moment that gives me great hope, not just about what might happen with that case, because obviously we're in a high-stakes situation with that case. What gives me hope is that they care enough to be involved at all. That shows a level of maturity in our movement that we have not yet, up to that point, achieved. So the hardest work that we need to do is this work around coalition, these allies, having these unlikely people step up. And then there's one final piece about how, as I reflect on the work we've got to do that lies ahead, and it's the hardest piece for me. And that is not making judgments about where someone sits relative to the rights of lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people based on who we see them as being. And what I speak of specifically is assuming that our opposition is monolithic, assuming that religious people, for example, even evangelical religious people, are opposed to LGBT equality. Several years ago, our family was up in Yosemite at Tenaya Lodge. There was a school camp retreat thing there. And my partner Sandy and I were there with our kids. And it turns out that at the same camp, at the same lodge, was this women's Christian retreat thing. And I have to say, I walked in, I saw the banners and the signs, and I immediately thought, I mean, I could feel my blood pressure going up. And my immediate reaction was, I was like in fight mode. Like that, those people, I immediately had this whole frame of this is the enemy. And we got on an elevator at one point, and a woman got on with us, and she had on this T-shirt. You remember the Cuckoo Cocoa Puffs bird? Remember that bird? Well, she had on this T-shirt, and it said, Cuckoo for Christ. Now, the first thing I thought was, well, that seems blasphemous to me. But the second thing I thought was, can't you be somewhere else? What are you doing here? You know, I didn't even want her in my space. That was sort of my first thought. And my second thought was hearing my mother's voice saying, honey, you got to give him a chance. And, you know, I'll end with a story about my mother because, and it's a story I've told before, so I apologize if you've heard it, but it's something that I carry with me so much, especially in this last piece of this fight, because I do think the barriers to winning a sense of full equality, safety, and security for LGBT people, I think we know how this story is going to end. We are going to have a win in terms of formal legal equality. And, you know, NCLR is a legal group. That may be the point at which we say, okay, great, you know, we've won these fights. Youth are safe. Immigrants are safe. You know, we're done. But there'll still be something more to do. And this cultural piece of hearts and minds, that's going to be the most difficult. And it will require us to have a level of patience and compassion and understanding that I don't think we do a very good job of cultivating. My mother had a stroke in 1991, and it was a very serious stroke. Up until that point, she had been she was really a live wire. You know, she was like 100 pounds, soaking wet, about 5'2", and just totally, she lit up a room when she would walk in. She had this stroke and immediately became, you know, it was difficult for her to walk. She could still live on her own, but she couldn't work anymore. You know, she couldn't really take care of her finances, so I really stepped in and did a lot of that stuff for her. About 10 years later, she had a second stroke. And by this time, I was living in San Francisco. And this is when, you know, my sister called me and said, look, you got to get here as soon as you can, obviously back to Utah. And I wasn't sure if I was going to make it. Well, I did make it. And then proceeded to be with my mother as she went through this hard slog of rehabilitation. And I remember being back there maybe a month later, and her speech therapist came to get her for speech therapy. And my mother was still having a hard time sort of putting sentences together. It really kind of took whatever was left about her her language skills. But so the speech therapist was asking her what would normally be, you know, very simple questions. How many kids do you have? What are your kids' names? And, you know, my mom was really trying to, you know, answer these questions appropriately, but it was interesting to hear these answers. And then the speech therapist looks at me and she said, well, you know, Kathy's here in town from San Francisco, why don't you tell us what Kathy does for a living? And I thought, well, this will be fascinating. And my mother looked at me, and she looked at the speech therapist, and she said, oh, what Kathy does is very important. She takes care of all the gays and lesbians in the world. And the speech therapist looks at me and says, well, that's an awfully big job. And about a year later, my mother died. And yet, in that moment, expressing to the speech therapist what I did for a living, you really have encapsulated this cheerleader. My mother was my greatest champion and yet loved her church. She held these two identities, seeming now, especially now that we know about the Mormon Church deep involvement in passing Prop 8, she held these two identities seemingly in tension effortlessly. She didn't ever pit one against another. She figured it would all work out at some other point. She wasn't going to worry about it. She loved her church. She loved me. That's all there was to it. So what I think of when I think of our next challenge and when I think of the woman with that T-shirt and I think of any other conversation I have with folks who have opposition to LGBT equality based on their religious beliefs is I think about my mother. And I think what her legacy is and what she would want her legacy to be to me is to never doubt that you might be able to make a difference, that you might be able to move someone and to forgive them if they don't and move on. And by doing that, you change minds that you can change. You don't struggle with who you can't. And you see over time, by any measure, that we've moved light years from where we've been. We know where we have to go. And with values of inclusion, safety, a sense of community, and a sense of that unconditional love, that's how we're going to get there. Thank you very much.
You are listening to a program of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Julian Chang, your moderator tonight. Our guest is Kate Kendall, Executive Director of National Center for Lesbian Rights. Kate, there's a bunch of questions here, and I've tried...
Start with the easy ones.
I've tried to group them a little bit. Let's talk about marriage, because same-sex marriage, because they are the most... It is the most pressing one on people's minds. So you mentioned that you have anyone's guess is as good as yours for the appeal process. Now, that doesn't sound like the former legal director of NCLR. I mean, if you were going to analyze the Supreme Court makeup, especially with Justice Kagan being seated, what do you think?
What do you mean by that, Julian?
what do you think are the chances of David and of Boies and Olson prevailing?
Well, you know, this is a fascinating case to watch, and there are many twists and turns that we're going to be facing. I think even before we get to that point. I mean, 30 days ago, if someone would have said to me, "Well, won't they?" The proponents of Prop 8 just be kicked out on standing, and the case will end here because they don't have standing to appeal. I would have said, and actually did say, because did get asked that question, oh, I just think that's very unlikely to happen. I think there's no doubt that this case is going to go up. Well, I now think, I still think it's more of a long shot than probable, but it will be a serious question about whether the proponents of Prop 8 do have standing to appeal, because the law, it's a Supreme Court case, and it is dicta, what we lawyers call, you know, not the key holding of the case, but it's pretty strong language that says ballot measure proponents do not have standing to prosecute an appeal. And in the absence of a state, I mean, it is the state of California that has the greatest interest in whether Prop 8 is enforced or not. They actually have skin in the game, if you will. The proponents
You know, they put it on the ballot. They won. They're kind of done at this point. It is now not a process that really gives them the right to say, this is our thing, because it's the state law that must be enforced. And they really don't stand in the shoes of the state. So the state said, look, we don't like this. We're done. We're not going to defend this on appeal. And it will be interesting to see what the Ninth Circuit does with that question. Everyone knows they've put a stay in place. They've expedited the case. And they've asked for briefing on that very specific issue. So there's nothing that would make me happier obviously. A Supreme Court victory is huge. Certainly to have couples be able to marry sooner in California would be a very good outcome as well. And that would happen much sooner if the proponents lose on standing. So I think that's going to just be an interesting armchair, sit back, have a beer, watch it happen, and see what goes on. Let's just assume the standing argument isn't enough to defeat proponents' effort to prosecute the appeal, and the appeal goes up. Look, you know, we all know that you've got to count to five. We need five votes. I think that when you look at the unique circumstances of Prop 8, how it actually eliminated a right recognized by the state Supreme Court, that is a quintessential denial of equal protection under the law. The law treats you all equally, and then it doesn't because the majority voted that it didn't. So, I think it's high stakes. Everyone knows that it's high stakes with this Supreme Court. And acknowledging that, I also know that it's going to be some period of time before we actually have to really buckle down and truly worry about what might happen at the Supreme Court. And at this point, I'm just enjoying the difference it's making, having a Ted Olson and David Boies out there talking about why this issue is so fundamental to our freedoms as a nation and how they're changing the discourse nationally. And actually, the wonky lawyer part of me, I'm putting in a cage and not allowing to kind of kill the buzz of, what's happening right now with the case. But, you know, let's just keep our fingers crossed and hope that by the time the case gets there, we're at five.
You mentioned tipping point and also people coming onto the side of equality. Of course, Ken Mellman, former chair of the RNC, has come out now as a gay man. Is this a result of the tipping point that he now feels that there's enough cover for him to be out? Your reaction?
Yes. I think, anytime someone is able to live a life of more personal integrity and authenticity, that is a good thing. And when that is denied to people, that is a bad thing. Ken Mellman coming out should be greeted with humanity and with compassion. But to the extent he wants or expects to be embraced by the LGBT community, there's some serious splaining he's got to do. And there's some serious work he needs to do on behalf of the community to create a different legacy. The legacy he leaves with us now is a tortured one and a horrific one for the LGBT community. And, you know, it just depends on who does he want to be. Does he want to be some marginal conservative Republican guy who happened to come out late in life? Well, that's fine. Does he really want to be a game-changing sort of figure who will own up and take accountability for what he did and apologize and attempt to make some sort of restitution to the community? That's the kind of guy I hope he's going to be. Only he can decide in his heart which path he's going to choose.
Does the moment after the tipping point occur result in some sort of blowback or backlash?
Yeah, all the time, continually.
And so what do we do when we get that backlash and blowback?
you know, steel yourself and keep on moving. I mean, I think every movement, I mean, this is the one thing that I think is important, and, you know, we have a board and we have board members here, and I really appreciate them being here, and we have staff here. One thing that our board and staff, I think, are always paying attention to is, you know, sort of taking lessons from other social justice movements, because for many reasons. One, it's sort of the right thing to do to understand where we can make alliances, where we can work in coalition, where we can be collaborative. And also it helps to not be at some pity party about how, oh my gosh, things are so bad for us and us alone. Every movement has, as you make inroads and you make social change, there is a reaction. It happens every single time. And for some reason in this culture, we always need somebody in that slot, in the slot where, of the scapegoat, in the slot of the one who's denying true American values or who's eroding true American values. And I feel like what we've seen as LGBT people have gained rights, we've seen immigrants be more and more scapegoated and more slotted into that position. And I think we have to resist that and say, oh, no, 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 no. No one needs to be in that slot. That slot is completely, it doesn't serve anyone. It doesn't make us a better country. It doesn't help anybody. That slot is not taking anything away from anybody else except demeaning us as human beings. So I think we just have to understand it's perfectly natural that there will be a blowback. What I have tried to do, and it's sort of the whole, you know, thinking about my mom thing, is the reason there's blowback is because people are scared. And so to have compassion for where they're coming from, at the same time I'm like, okay, I feel bad for you, but guess what? We're moving on. You know, we're not going to change our course. We're still going to push. We're still going to be fierce advocates for ourselves. But it doesn't mean not acknowledging that, you know, I understand this is nervous making for you, but just see you later, and we'll see you on the other side of this, and you'll find out it's all going to be okay.
Do you think that's an effective strategy? Because Bishop Spong, the noted Episcopal bishop, issued a manifesto a few months ago that just basically said, talk to the hand. I'm done. I'm not going to engage in the least common denominator. I'm not going to bend over for your prejudices. I will not accommodate your hate speech in any way, shape, or form. So what do you talk about after, when you just say, just talk to the hand?
You talk to somebody else. You know, because there's for every person who is unreachable, I mean, my partner Sandy, for example, has told me this a couple of different times. My partner is African American, and she said, okay, you know one thing I'm never going to do anymore is talk to white people about race. I am done having that conversation. But I will talk to my people about sexual orientation. So we just have to say, who are we willing to have conversations with? We can't say we're not going to talk to anybody about these issues. Okay, you're not going to talk to church people, that's fine. Are you going to talk to, you know, mill workers or people who have lost their job and are concerned about their economic security and just don't know anyone who's gay? They don't have a philosophical or a religious-based value against LGBT people. It just seems like foreign, completely foreign. There's someone who we have to be willing to talk to that's not just the choir, or we're not helping to change the conversation. So find a different audience then. We don't all have to talk to everybody, but find an audience that you can tolerate talking to and talk to those people.
And changing subjects, some young women today feel that the label a feminist does not apply to them because it's too strident, it's not cool, and it was, you know, for older women. And look how far we've come. What would you say to those young women?
I understand that, and I think that they're right. That is their frame. And I won't make anyone gay who doesn't want to be gay. I'm not going to make anyone a feminist who doesn't want to be a feminist. But I do think it's important to understand where we've come from and how we've gotten where we are. And while I know that, you know, one identifying as a feminist will definitely mark you in the generation people think you were born, they'll know exactly the decade in which you were born if you identify as a feminist. I think it's important, and you know, to have these conversations. I mean, we have these conversations in our family, and you know, my 8-year-old and my 8-year-old daughter and 14-year-old son, boy, they know feminism and they know sexism when they see it. And Julian's like watching a TV show and like, that looks sexist, Mom. And I'm like, yes, that is sexist, son. And I think it's without being pedantic or making somebody feel like, you know, they're in a bad women's studies class, I think you can. You can have a conversation about, okay, just let's just keep in mind that to the extent you feel safer at work, to the extent that someone is not asking for a quid pro quo of sexual favors in order for you to get advancement in your position, that's because you're standing on the shoulders of women who were in exactly that position and who fought to change laws. And it doesn't, you don't have to identify by a label. You just have to know that you are in a more privileged place because there were women who really suffered and pioneers who really paved a way when there was no path about what it was going to look like and what was around the corner, who made it possible for you to feel like you can apply for that job that seems like a little bit of a stretch. And you don't even think about that you might not get it because of your gender. You're only worried that, oh, maybe I don't have a PhD from the right school. That's what you need to know.
You mentioned that even in today's age, women are making 77 cents to the dollar for men. Within the context of the LGBT community, what would be the next agenda item for lesbians beyond marriage equality?
Well, I mean, for us, when they all, I can just speak about sort of about NCLR. When we think about the next kind of generation of issues beyond marriage equality, one thing that we always ask ourselves is, who's being left behind? Whose issues are not being addressed? So I think that what our community, there will be a number of people who once we win marriage, we will never see them again. That's all they care about. But I don't think that will be the majority of LGBT people. And I think, I hope that the majority of LGBT people will still be around to fight for greater economic and job security for transgender people who suffer enormously based on their gender identity and who live far below the poverty line and suffer, you know, incredible rates of violence and hostility based on who they are, that there's going to have to be a whole beyond marriage conversation. I mean, because one thing that our value at NCLR is we don't feel like people should have to marry in order to have their relationship protected and recognized, and to have a certain level of economic security. So what's that going to look like? I mean, it's been very disconcerting for us to, for example, see marriage won in Massachusetts, and once marriage was won there, all of the domestic partner protections went away. And that, I think, is not the right model. I think we want a marriage and another range of protections that people could choose to be a part of that are short of the full requirements and the full responsibilities associated with marriage. But I think those are going to be take some serious work, and you know, that's work that we're committed to.
Locally, what do you feel has been NCLR's greatest achievement then?
No offense to the person who wrote this question, but I hate this question. I mean, I think part of the reason the question is a difficult one is that in some way, it requires me to engage in some hierarchy of the work that we do. And that's just really tough for me to do. Because so much of, you know, I mean, a natural answer to this question that many people would think we might say is winning the marriage case in California. You know, we were lead counsel on the marriage case, winning that case before the California Supreme Court, because that's the big headline case. And that is no doubt an enormous accomplishment, and certainly was, you know, holding that ruling that day was, you know, the highlight of my legal career. But I think what I am more proud of in terms of what we've accomplished is paving the way for that ruling to be possible by 15 years earlier and 10 years earlier taking parenting cases, some cases that involve straight parents, because it was a straight dad who had raised a child as his own with his wife, and they split up, and that's when she says, oh, but guess what? You're not the dad. And it turns out he's not the biological father. But we got involved in that case and won him parental rights. And when we got involved in that case, people were like, why are you representing a straight guy? Well, now we can all see exactly why. Because any lesbian or gay man standing in those shoes as not the biological parent but as the functional parent needs to have the rights protected. So we were able, when the California Supreme Court ruled on the marriage case, they relied on this whole body of law that we had helped been a part of developing. And that was, so I think I'm most proud of the landscape we lay. And then sometimes, you know, we don't even get to be the ones that plant the oak tree. You know, we just till the ground and, you know, the fertilizer's all in there. And then all of a sudden, you know, unbeknownst to us, something comes along and, boy, the next thing we know, there's this big thing sprouted there. And yet we can take and we, you know, we don't have to have some big credit for it. It's just we're like, oh, yeah, but see that little way that that blade of grass is growing? We did that part. And so it's really sort of laying the groundwork for kind of other things to happen and being open to other things happening.
Would you have ever foreseen the range of marriage equality around the world, Spain, Argentina, and now Mexico? And what are the implications of these non-Northern European countries going towards marriage equality? And we're still fighting for it.
You know, this is where I would just have to acknowledge my own ethnocentricity. You know, I just thought we were going to be first. You know, the United States was, of course, you know, this bastion of democracy and fairness and fundamental human rights that, of course, we would be at the vanguard. And, you know, I mean, totally proven wrong and in a delightful way. I mean, I think to some degree it has to be a little bit, I mean, shaming is the wrong word because I don't want to have such a value-laden word, but to have so many countries step into the queue ahead of us, countries that you would not expect. I mean, the last time I was at the Commonwealth Club was moderating a discussion with the Spanish advocates who had won marriage in Spain. You know, this very, very Catholic country. But, you know, it goes to show what happens when you have a leader who will actually do what he says he's going to do on your behalf and really, like, put it all on the line. And they've won it there, and they've been able to keep it there. And so I think part of the so I think it's definitely helped. It's definitely helped to move the conversation. But because the country overall is so ethnocentric, no one cares what happens in any other country. You know, we don't look to international law when it comes to some of the key human rights issues that we face. You know, who cares what they're doing, you know, in Mexico or Spain or the Netherlands or anywhere else? We're about the U.S. of A., okay? So I think it has an effect on the margins, and it has an effect in terms of putting pressure in some places, and it's particularly around federal policy pieces. There are folks in different agencies that can kind of see that and pay attention to it and can put pressure there. In terms of actually changing the hearts and minds of, you know, red-blooded Americans, I don't think it has that much of an impact. But, you know, if 80% of the country had passports instead of 20%, it might make more of a difference.
You are listening to a program of the Commonwealth Club of California. Our speaker tonight is Kate Kendall, Executive Director of the National Center for Lesbian Rights. Congratulations to NCLR for winning the Hastings Christian Legal Society case. Could you explain a little bit about that case and why it was so important for NCLR to take on that case and win it?
Yeah, this is one of the, you know, there are cases where you look at Supreme Court victories, and I have to say, it has been an amazing summer for LGBT issues and LGBT rights. And this was a case that was announced by the U.S. Supreme Court at the beginning of the summer. And, you know, not because NCLR was involved, but just viewed objectively as a lawyer advocating for our community, you know, we've got huge victories, Lawrence versus Texas, Romer versus Evans, and I think the Hastings case. And the reason I would put it up there at the same level is because it's it really cuts off at the knees a strategy that the right has been using. So Christian Legal Society is a student organization. They sought formal recognition from Hastings Law School as a recognized student group. Hastings said, well, you have to comply with our non-discrimination policy, excuse me, if you want formal legal recognition. You can be a student group, you know, you can have members, you can meet, but you can't get student fees. You can't get money to be supported in your activities unless you comply with our non-discrimination policy. And they said, no, we want to be exempted from that because we don't want to accept non-Christians and we don't want to accept LGBT people. And Hastings said, well, then, sorry, we're not going to recognize you as a formal student group. We're not going to give you money to support your activities. Now, CLS then sued. They had threatened to sue or sued, what was it, 5, 6 law schools before, and the law schools had all caved and said, okay, fine, we'll give you an exemption. You don't have to. We'll still recognize you. We'll still give you money. Now, keep in mind, this is like taxpayer money. This is like student fee money. We'll still give you money, but you don't have to comply with a non-discrimination policy. Hastings, to their credit, said, no, we're not going to recognize you. We, Hastings was represented by a separate firm. We intervened on behalf of Outlaw, which is the LGBT student group. And so the Outlaw was also a party to the lawsuit, and we represented them. The strategy that the Supreme Court rejected is that the right in a number of different forums, not just law schools and student groups, because, you know, how many people would care about that, but in a number of different forums, had been attempting to pit religious freedom and exercise of religion against non-discrimination policies. So you could imagine the scenarios. A doctor doesn't have to treat a lesbian. You know, a pharmacist doesn't have to give out birth control. You know, that maybe rentals doesn't apply because there's a Supreme Court case on that. But employers, for example, you know, we don't have to hire those people because that would offend our religious beliefs. So they had very methodically been trumping non-discrimination laws by using their religious freedom and religious belief as the argument for why non-discrimination laws shouldn't apply to them. So we were really concerned about what might happen with this case. So we won at the trial court, we won at the Court of Appeal, and we were all, let me just say, a little bit sick to our stomach. The Supreme Court agreed to hear the case. Now, what normally happens as a lawyer, I mean, this is never perfect, a perfect science, but generally, if you win a case on appeal and the Supreme Court agrees to review it, it means they're going to do something different. Now, that is not always true by any means, but that's kind of the general way things go. So we were very concerned when the Supreme Court agreed to take the case. But then we had oral argument. Our legal director, Shannon Minter, attended the oral argument, felt much better after attending the oral argument because he felt like the court really was getting what the issue was. What the issue was is Christian Legal Society, supported by very well-funded anti-gay legal groups. They have their same groups like we do. They've really learned how to work this system. They were asking for an exemption from non-discrimination laws to say we should be able to discriminate because it's our religious beliefs that would be offended by having to comply with this non-discrimination law. And the Supreme Court, It was 5-4. Okay, I'm looking at Melanie Rowan, who's our staff attorney. So the Supreme Court, in a 5-4 ruling, obviously split very close, rejected Christian Legal Society's argument and said, oh, no. You don't get an exemption from a non-discrimination law that applies to everybody else equally. Especially, I mean, you can still be a student group, but if you want money, if you want government support for your activities, you must comply with non-discrimination protections. You can still have your religious beliefs. We're not saying you need to believe differently. But if you want us to support those religious beliefs financially, you need to comply with non-discrimination laws. And that holding has just annihilated this key strategy that has been building for 2 decades by the right. They have been building this architecture to take down non-discrimination laws. And just like that, the House of Cards has fallen, and I think it will have enormous ramifications of what it's less like a Lawrence versus Texas, where all these laws that criminalized same-sex sexual intimacy are struck down, or Romer versus Evans, where Amendment 2 is struck down. What's important about the Hastings lawsuit is it will prevent what could have happened if this strategy had been allowed to go forward, but still hugely significant.
I'm going to ask you to put on your fortune teller hat. Talking about House of Cards, what do you see with Don't Ask, Don't Tell? Do you think it'll pass Congress this year? It's up for a floor vote on the Senate in September.
Knowing that this is going to be on the radio and so that it'll be recorded for time and all eternity, which is a Mormon statement for any of the Mormons in the crowd, makes me just, radio be damned. Don't Ask, Don't Tell is perhaps the last bastion of formally recognized and approved federal government discrimination against a whole category of people. I mean, you've got DOMA as well, and that's it's slightly different. This is where you're just saying, based on who you are, you are unfit to be a part of the armed services. And I know that Don't Ask, Don't Tell doesn't really do that, and if you don't tell, they won't ask, and blah, that's all crap. People are being discharged at the very same rate, and in fact higher rates than they ever were under the previous policy. So Don't Ask, Don't Tell, if it was ever meant to operate that way, is completely broken. And we are now losing service members by huge numbers, mostly lesbians, actually, although that will not be surprising to any lesbians in the crowd, mostly lesbians who join the armed services, but also obviously an inordinate number of gay men. And there's obviously a huge deterrent effect. People who will not ever sign up for military service because they don't want to have to deal with living a lie and not being authentic to who they are. So it's a huge national security issue. There's no sense for it. Every study that's ever been done says this is ridiculous. The best study ever done from the RAND Corporation found that it would not harm unit cohesion or any of that. What concerns me about the prospects of getting Don't Ask, Don't Tell repealed is this ridiculous process that the administration has been engaging in to get information about determining whether Don't Ask, Don't Tell should be repealed. And so they're asking questions of both service members and the spouses of service members that are essentially the equivalent of, are you okay showering with a gay man if he's looking at you and is interested in you sexually? I mean, that is about how bad these questions are. And to the spouses, is it okay with you if your husband is serving with gay men who may be sexually attracted to him? I mean, that is essentially how ridiculous these questions are. And yet, so it's a self-fulfilling prophecy how these surveys are going to come back. If it weren't for all of that monkey business, I actually would feel like Don't Ask, Don't Tell has a lot of support from the Joint Chiefs. It has support, majority support in the country for repealing it. You know, most of us don't want to join the military, so we're happy to have somebody else join who wants to. But the process by which this information gathering is happening makes me very suspicious about the real motives and the real energy and political will behind repealing it. So I hope and want to believe that statements taken at face value that Don't Ask, Don't Tell is a top agenda item to be repealed this year are true. I think we have to, if we want to make those statements a reality, we are going to have to put a ton of pressure on, because the other side, our opposition, is actually very actively working against seeing Don't Ask, Don't Tell repealed. So it's going to take our community really rallying in a huge way. It won't happen if we sit around and don't do anything about it.
We have to talk about ENDA. What do you think about ENDA passing Congress this year, too?
The Employment Non-Discrimination Act has been rattling around Congress for 15 years. It should be a very simple matter, especially when you have polls that show 80% support for the proposition that people should not lose their jobs based on their sexual orientation or their gender identity. It's appalling that we did not see INDA move earlier in Congress. And, you know, I've been a critic of politicians. I've spoken directly to Nancy Pelosi, saying that we really need her leadership on this. You know, and the answer we get back is, look, we can't even get a jobs bill through Congress to try to put Americans back to work. I mean, this is a toxic environment in D.C. And I acknowledge that. I know things are tough, and it's like, you know, but that's your job. And promises were made that INDA would move. I feel like our community has really stepped up to try to see the Employment Non-Discrimination Act pass. But, again, as with Don't Ask, Don't Tell, I'm just very fearful, particularly as we get close to midterms, that the House is not going to take another tough vote, particularly on an issue that could hurt, they say, could hurt Democrats in swing districts. So I feel like at some point in the not-too-distant future, what our community is going to be really tested about is how are we going to hold accountable politicians who are not the fierce advocate they say they're going to be or who don't do what they say they were going to do in terms of moving our legislation. And it may mean that things are tougher for us in the short run because maybe Republicans win some seats because we sit back or we don't get engaged or we won't vote for people who did not move the issues we wanted. But we're going to have another, I think in the next couple of years, our community is going to have to look closely, very seriously, at some of our strategies politically, and we may just have to play some hardball and see more stepping back in the near term in order to win over the longer term.
And now it's come to the part of the program where we have one last question for you. What would you be doing if you weren't running NCLR?
Is my salary already paid? Are my kids taken care of? I don't have to worry about money. Well, you know, it's interesting. I haven't ever said this publicly, but why not now? My sister and I have been having conversations with a literary agent. And what we've been talking about doing is writing a book. My sister is a devout Mormon, still, very much in the sort of mold of my mother. And obviously, you all know what I do. Get paid for being a lesbian. So, and yet my sister, like my mother, completely loves and embraces me. And I've made peace with her religious views and the fact that she is devoutly Mormon. And so the literary agent has been talking to us about writing a book of how we navigate that territory and saying, you know, could we write something that could speak to a broader audience about some of the stuff I was talking about bridging that difference and having that chasm be not quite so deep. So I've been giving that a lot of thought, and, you know, my day job's sort of getting in the way of actually making that real. But I think, as my sister and I talk about it, we're both really excited about it, and we both feel like it would be, if nothing else, and if no one ever reads it and it never gets published, even if we were to just do it, it would be a great tribute to our mother. So that's what in the near term, at least, that's what I would be doing.
Thank you, Kate Kendall. Our guest tonight has been Kate Kendall, Executive Director of the National Center of Lesbian Rights. I want to thank you on behalf of the Commonwealth Club and especially for the LGBT member-led forum. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club celebrating 107 years of bringing enlightenment and truth is adjourned.
Thank you, my dear. I enjoyed that.